This is an I Am Listening exclusive podcast.
So I thought, I'll go to A&E, I've caught a bug in South Africa, they'll give me some tablets, I'll have some fluids and I'll go home. And no, it was very, very much not the case. So I ended up being told that I had 3% kidney function. So that was a Wednesday I went in, I was told I had 3% kidney function and that I was being admitted and taken straight through to RESUS.
Welcome to Dr. Nikki Explains. I'm Dr. Nikki, a GP of 24 years experience, and this is my friend Sarah.
I'm a mum of four with no medical background.
We've decided to do a podcast to explain medical conditions, hopefully in an accessible way. We often have a guest speaker who has experience or expertise.
The podcast is not a substitute for seeing your GP. If you have medical symptoms that are troubling you, please see a doctor.
We've based the podcasts on NICE guidelines, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence.
The podcasts do contain graphic descriptions of medical conditions and may not be suitable for a younger audience or those of a sensitive nature.
Thank you for listening. We're here to do another podcast today, kidneys, which is a really interesting topic. And so, Sarah, thanks for coming again and supporting me.
No problem at all, Nikki. We've actually got two Sarahs tonight.
We have.
A brace of Sarahs. Aren't we lucky?
So we have a guest speaker, Sarah. And Sarah, you are very experienced in this area, as we're going to find out.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come and talk to us today.
Yeah, it's brilliant because kidneys is something that I know very little about. So I've been looking forward to this enormously. Should we start off with the sort of basics? What is a kidney and what does it do?
So most people have two kidneys. They sit in your back, just below your rib cage, and normally about the size of a fist. And so most people think that all kidneys do is make urine. That's their only thing they do. But actually, they do a lot for the body. So they are basically the filter system. So all of the waste in your body gets cleared. Most of the waste gets cleared through your kidneys. So it's the filter in that, but as well as the other bits, it helps remove all the toxins. It helps control your blood pressure. It actually makes you produce red blood cells. So there's your kidney creates a hormone that makes your bone marrow make more red blood cells. So if you have damage to your kidney, you can actually become a bit anemic as well. And it also activates vitamin D. So without kidneys, you can't activate your vitamin D to be used properly.
And so that keeps your bones healthy, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a lot of things. So it's bone health, it's heart health because it's looking at your blood pressure, and it's also generally all over kind of keeping out all those toxins.
Pretty amazing.
Kidneys are also really, really clever at controlling the water level in your body. So if you're a desert camel, for example, the kidneys in a camel are designed to absorb as much water as they possibly can from the blood system. Whereas if you're an animal or a human being that has water around all the time, then the kidney design is such that we don't absorb so much water, but we can when we need it. So if we're getting very dehydrated, the kidney will absorb more water. So it's a very, very clever system.
And it's quite effective. So your kidneys will filter about 180 litres of blood a day within 24 hours. So all your blood that's going around the body is constantly being filtered through the kidneys. And those electrolytes and water are either being excreted or they're being flushed out through your kidneys, through your urine, or the body's keeping hold of them. So it's kind of keeping an eye on what levels are in your blood. And it's very smart at being able to work at a really high volume, but also be able to change on a bit of a dime as to how much they're working, how little they're working. So yeah, they're quite fascinating.
It's sort of a balancer, really. Keeps you all in balance. Wow.
And I quite often describe the filtering part of it as a little bit like if you ever have posh coffee, Sarah, with a cafetiere and a filter.
Ooh, I like that.
Basically, what you do then is you put the water through the filter paper, and I'm pointing here, which has got has no effect on a podcast. But basically, the filter keeps the grouts from going through, but it filters through the sort of smaller molecules, but it keeps the big molecules the other side. The kidney does the same thing; it stops protein going through. It doesn't want to filter out the protein from your blood. It keeps that in, but it gets rid of toxins, certain toxins in the urine.
So amazing then that since it does so many jobs that people can exist with just one.
Yeah. So most people have two, but some people actually have three and some people are born with just one kidney. So the average human has two, but yet people can live with just one kidney. It's fascinating.
Amazing. Yeah. So signs and symptoms, I mean, presumably it's fine when they're all working, but when it goes wrong, I mean, how would I know that my kidneys...
Well, it'll be interesting actually to check with Sarah to see what happened when her kidneys went wrong. But the things as GPs we look out for are, and this sounds a bit strange, but foamy urine. You know when you are separating your yolk from the white of your egg and you slightly start whisking it and it looks sort of slightly bubbly? That's actually what happens to the urine in people with kidney disease, because we talked, didn't we, about the filter paper keeping protein into the blood. When you have kidney disease, you damage that filter paper, you damage the filtration system, and protein starts to come through. And that is why urine starts to look foamy and bubbly. People often also urinate more than they ought to. That's because that water balance that the kidney does very well has failed.
Do you mean that they
wee a lot
more? They wee more in amount or more often?
More often, or some, well, it's actually, it can be either. It can actually be more often or less often.
I see.
Either, actually. So that's something that, the problem with that is that's a vague symptom. It's not always something you would necessarily notice.
So foamy wee.
Foamy wee. Weeing more often or less often than normal.
A change in weeing.
Itchy or dry skin, which Sarah might have had, I don't know. Feeling very tired, that's usually the sort of accumulation of toxins. Feeling a bit sick and losing your appetite a bit, that's the toxins as well, because it's not filtering them out. Some people will lose some weight. Sometimes you can even get blood in the urine. You can get puffiness of your ankles and around your eyes. You can get muscle cramps. And then, you know, as it gets worse, trouble concentrating, achy, crampy muscles, sometimes even breathlessness because the fluid accumulates, actually being sick, trouble sleeping. And people describe breath smelling like ammonia or like fish. And that's because you're not getting rid of ammonia like you should be.
Okay.
But it'd be interesting to hear what. So how did yours develop? Did you get those symptoms?
So in hindsight, yes. But at the time, probably not. So I went into A&E quite quickly. I was 27, completely fine, no kind of prior history of anything, and came back from a holiday in South Africa and just felt worse and worse and worse and kept being sick, couldn't stop being sick, didn't really want to eat. And so eventually I ended up being feeling so awful. I just said to my mum, take me to A&E. I just need to go to A&E.
And because presumably you thought there was something to do with your holiday.
Yeah. So I thought, I'll go to A&E. I've caught a bug in South Africa. They'll give me some tablets. I'll have some fluids and I'll go home. And no, it was very, very much not the case. So I ended up being told that I had 3% kidney function. So that was a Wednesday I went in. I was told I had 3% kidney function and that I was being admitted and taken straight through to resus. And I'll come on to kind of what happened after that in a bit. But the symptoms are very, so the urea, so that's the ammonia that builds up, it makes you really stupid. So you feel really forgetful. It feels like you've just had sudden onset dementia. You can't find your words. You can't think in a straight sentence. Lots of puffiness. So some people do get quite bad swelling that you can see. I held all my fluid inside. So you only noticed it. The only time I really got swelling was after a Kaylee dance where the centrifugal effect, a big spun round the dancer.
Forced you to puff up.
Caused my feet to puff.
Oh, when I, dear.
Yeah.
It's like a good Kaylee.
Yes. And so, yeah, you do get that taste. So it's really like you're tasting pennies.
Right.
So nothing tastes right. So I think that was the worst thing about, one of the worst things about kidney disease for me, is that I was hungry, but anytime I ate, I felt sick or I was sick. And anything I ate tasted or didn't taste the same. Tasted metallic and just awful. Just really like, and it sometimes tastes like the smell of urine in your mouth. It's, it's really unpleasant. So that was that. And you do get this muscle pain. So one of the toxins that build up is phosphate, and it can be really painful. You just get...
I didn't know why that was.
Yes, significant bone pain and real itchiness. So the urea makes you itch, and it's an itch that you can never quite scratch. And this is talking of, like, in terms of kidney disease of end stage. So I was very much... no function almost.
Yeah.
And so people will have a variety of symptoms as their function would get worse. And I think the thing that's important is with this is that there's varying stages of kidney disease. So there's they stage it from stage one being pretty much normal down to stage five, which is kind of what they call end stage renal disease. And that's when you're looking at treatment in terms of replacing your kidney function.
And just for the sake of listeners, renal means kidney.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there's probably about 3.5 million people with chronic disease in that sort of lower range of 3 to 5. So about, and then another sort of 2 million in that better range. So about 7 million people in the UK have chronic kidney disease.
Which is more than 10% of the population.
That is extraordinary.
Yes, it is extraordinary, isn't it?
Is that anything, is it male, female, old, young? Tell me about who it affects.
It's mainly a disease of sort of older people. So I think Nikki's going to go on to all the things that can cause kidney failure. And as you get older, all of your organs do start to not work as well as they used to. So it is predominantly a disease of the elderly, but with rising things like diabetes, high blood pressure, health inequalities, chronic economic inequalities, you're finding actually that there is a big rise in that middle age group of people who are being diagnosed with chronic kidney disease. There are a large proportion of people that are diagnosed quite young, and that tends to be because they have either structural, so actual kidney was born a bit wonky, or they've got a genetic reason that is causing that. But so you are starting to see more and more people in that sort of working age who are developing CKD that previously would have never developed.
So I think, you know, anyone can develop kidney disease at any age, but some risk factors make you more likely to get it. And Sarah's just mentioned some of those. So diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease or heart failure. As you say, the kind of genetic history of abnormalities. We have a family in my practice area that has polycystic kidney disease. That's a genetic abnormality where instead of the very fine structure of the kidney that you would normally see, there's big cysts disrupting the function. Over the age of 60 is a risk factor. Family history is a risk factor. Obesity, personal history of acute kidney injury. So what that means is, if you've, well, I suppose you could have had a traumatic accident to your kidney, but also you could have had, again, I've got a young patient in my practice who's had a nasty bacterial infection that damaged her kidney when she was young, and that will give her a risk of developing failure later. Smoking is a risk factor because it damages the blood supply to the kidneys. And then there's sort of more rare conditions, inherited ones we've mentioned, autoimmune conditions, which Sarah's going to talk about because that's what affected her. And severe infection, I've mentioned there's something under that category called hemolytic uremic syndrome. What's that? So that's a very medical term. What that actually is the thing I was mentioning with this young girl. It's a bacterial infection, and the toxin then goes on to damage the kidneys, which can be quite devastating, obviously, if you're young and your kidneys pack up from this condition. And then, of course, there's always other conditions, but things like stones can cause damage, abnormalities that you're born with. So
is alcohol?
It isn't, but I'd like to say it is. No, I mean, no, you can have your glass of wine. It's
okay.
Fine.
Yeah. Fine.
Alcohol's more a liver, because alcohol is processed in the liver. So, yeah, that's more of a liver.
No, this is smoking. No smoking.
No smoking, I'm afraid. So, yes. And then the problem is, as your kidney disease gets worse, your risk of getting complications increases. And so, obviously, because it's linked to high blood pressure, and because the kidney controls blood pressure. So there's two mechanisms here. One is, if you've got high blood pressure and you've got a very fine filter system, you can imagine pushing your coffee through the filter paper really hard because you've got high blood pressure. Mm. So you're forcing that liquid through the kidney. That is going to damage the fine filtration system. But in addition, the kidney itself controls blood pressure. So both those factors magnify to give you problems, because if you then, because your kidney's damaged, have high blood pressure, that high blood pressure is going to go on and damage your heart, maybe give you a risk of stroke.
And if you've got low blood pressure, does it not go through enough?
Low blood pressure, apart from feeling a bit dizzy and that's a problem, but generally it does okay with your kidney. Kidney can take it quite low. Anemia is a problem which we've touched on because it makes red blood cells. You can build up acid in your blood. That's a complication because that's called metabolic acidosis.
So it controls the acid balance in your body. So once that becomes damaged, that's when that acid can start to build up.
It can cause bone problems, as we discussed with the vitamin D issue, and the calcium and phosphorus get out of balance. It can cause high potassium in the blood, especially if it's it happens over a short time period. So I suspect when Sarah went to hospital, I expect your potassium was rather high.
Yes, it was. And having high potassium, you need potassium for the electrics in your heart to work. But if you have too high a potassium level, you're more likely for the electrics to short circuit. And so you're much more likely to have a heart attack with having very high potassium or having sort of abnormalities in the electrical function of your heart. So yes, when I went in, my potassium was quite high. And I'd spent quite a few times in hospital after the fact with having high potassium, because that's one of those things that they really worry about.
So it's probably about time to hear about Sarah's story. I mean, it probably wasn't the end of the holiday that you'd imagined. So did you actually get to enjoy the holiday?
Some of it. So in the first few weeks I did, and then around Christmas time, so I think Christmas Day, I started to feel quite bad. We were on an elephant safari on the top of Yaddo Mountains, and I just threw up my entire Christmas dinner and spent the day feeling atrocious. And it just continued from there. So I thought I'd just caught a bug. Part of me was thinking maybe I had malaria, not that I overreact. But actually, malaria would have been quite nice compared to it. Yes. So my mum took me into, I was feeling worse and worse and worse. Thought I had a urine infection, was given antibiotics, which actually probably would have damaged my function even further because they're slightly toxic to your kidneys if you don't have good function. So I then ended up in A&E, as I said, taken through to resus. And actually that doctor said, as I went into A&E, she said, I wouldn't have normally taken your bloods, but only for the fact that you've gone on a foreign holiday recently, we'll just take them and we'll see what has going to come up. And so she put a cannula in to take the bloods, said, we'll give you some fluids, we'll give you some anti-sickness, it'll all be okay and we'll send you home. She came back in about 40 minutes later, and it's the only time I've ever seen a doctor slightly well up, as she went, I need to take another sample. Your kidney function's at 3%. And she said, if she hadn't taken the blood, she would have thought it had been an incorrect sample. So second blood test was taken and confirmed that my function was at 3%. And I was taken through to resus.
You're okay talking about it?
Oh, yeah. I don't mind.
No.
I don't mind at all. Taken through to resus. And then I spent a few days in Darrow Valley while I had about 7 different consultants around me trying to work out why my kidneys had just overnight
packed up.
It
probably wasn't overnight, was it?
It felt like it was overnight. Yeah. And I think I was gradually becoming more and more unwell.
And both kidneys had stopped working.
Yeah. So normally when you have sort of something happen to your kidneys, unless it's to do with more of the structure, it's things like, so I had a disease called anti-glomerular basement membrane disease. I can't get the name
right. To be fair.
Dear listeners, I mean, the person who's actually suffered from this is unable to pronounce it. Yes. So I think we can be forgiven.
These terminologies are very long and complex. Another name, good pastures.
Good pastures, yes. So we're not allowed to name syndromes after people anymore, but historically it's been called good pastures.
Slightly easier to say, that's all.
Right.
So it's anti-GBM is what you technically call it. Yeah, anti-glomerular basement membrane disease.
Anti-GBM.
Okay. So, so if it's something like that, both kidneys tend to conk out at the same time or at the same level. So a few days in King's, which is quite scary, my family were told, and I was told, we don't know what other organ it's going to go for next. So just, it's a waiting game to see what else conks out first.
So Sarah, is it true that good pastures or anti-GBM disease is a autoimmune disease?
Yes. So we went through all of that and we had all the tests, and finally my blood got whisked off to Exeter and Newcastle and all around, and they realised that I had this anti-GBM. So what basically happened is my immune system decided that the filter part of my kidney was a foreign body and that it needed to attack it. So there's you have something called your glomerula, and that is the filtery bits. They're a bit like, those claw clip hair.
Yes.
Like the little fingers, the glomerula, and they obviously attach down at the bottom to the base of the claw clip. So that is the bit that my body starts to attack, was the bit that actually holds the glomerula onto my actual kidney. So it started to attack those. I ended up at King's and had a biopsy where they took a section of my kidney and had a look at it under the microscope to see how many of those were damaged. I'm very rarely say this, but I'm quite lucky, because the other part of good pastures is that it would then, once it's sort of ravaged your kidneys, it then starts to detect the very similar protein, so similar membrane in your lungs, and it can start to damage the part of your alveoli, which are the sort of, I guess,
they're the
tiny little air sacs in your lungs where they do that sort of air exchange. So quite a similar part of the body, but just a bit of a different place. And it would have taken those out. And that's when you start to kind of bleed into your lungs and have much more problems. So, yes.
And do you have any idea what triggered this autoimmune response?
No. I've had my entire genetic sequence done to see there is a very rare cases where they can find a genetic abnormality that means that you're much more likely to have a relapse of anti-GBM. But I didn't have that, so that's quite good. But they have no idea what triggers it. Relapse is very unlikely, but it's not unheard of that people don't have relapses and it affect my transplant. So I now have a kidney, but there is a risk that at some point it could come back.
Oh, gosh. It won't.
Because of that, I had to be... So they basically turned my immune system off. So they turned my immune system off, tried to filter out more of the toxins and more of this bit of my immune system that had decided to go rogue. And you had to be at least 6 months clear so they can measure. There's actually a titer for looking at the anti-GBM level. So I have it's a natural molecule they were looking for. You can measure that titer, that level. And I had to be completely clear of that, undetectable for at least 6 months before I could be even thinking about having a transplant, because they wanted to make sure that I was
not going to attack the new kidney.
Yeah, 100% in remission before I moved on.
And for all of that time, were you in hospital?
So I was in hospital for about 4 weeks. And then I was on really heavy doses of drugs for about 3 months. We'll go on to talk about the sort of treatments for end-stage kidney disease, but I had dialysis for a full year before I got my kidney. So yeah,
we'll talk about dialysis. Yes. So Sarah, what sort of tests are there for the kidney?
So there's two different tests. So as you said, it's the filtering of your blood. So there is something called creatinine, and people who've sort of worked out might have heard of creatinine before.
Is when you say that again slowly?
Creatinine.
Right, okay.
So it's basically breakdown of muscle. So anything that kind of goes in your body, you break down creatinine, and that is the main thing that your kidney will filter to look at your function. So we do a blood test to see actually how well is your kidney filtering out that. So it looks at the level. It's something called estimated glomerular filtration rate. So we look at that, and that almost gives us a sort of percentage of your kidney.
And when you say we look at this, is this something that can be done at the local GP?
It's a blood test. So we would tend to, it's called the EGFR, is estimated glomerular filtration rate. And what that is just doing is exactly what Sarah says, estimating how well your kidneys are filtering. And also creatinine is a waste product. So you don't want to see that going up high in your blood, because it should be being got rid of by the kidney. And then the other thing we look for is protein in the urine, because as we discussed before, the kidney shouldn't be filtering out. It should be blocking protein from being filtered with that very fine filter paper. So if protein's in your urine, it means that that filter is leaky. So we also do urine dips to quantify the amount of protein in the urine. And those really are the main ways that we can test. Obviously, we can image the kidneys as well. So that's usually done by either a scan or an ultrasound scan or a CT scan.
So actually, if anyone's concerned and they had those symptoms, first port of call, GP.
Yes.
And this can be eliminated very quickly or indeed picked up, and better to go rather than to wait until you've get to the stage that you were at. yeah, gosh, it sounds frightening. So drugs, I mean, treatment, once this has been picked up, if the GP thought you did have problems, I mean, presumably that would be stage sort of one or two, or?
So we would stage it, and the staging is basically on, so there's two different ways we stage. We would stage mainly looking at how your function was, so looking at that EGFR. So we would class you into stage 1, 2, 3A, 3B. So that one's got a little bit of a different two categories, 4 and 5. And then we also stage based on how much protein has come out of your urine. And so that's A1, which is minimal, 2, which is moderate, and 3, which is significant. Based on what that looks like, there is also a risk score now of how likely you are in the next 5 years to progress to dialysis using those and other bits. So based on that is where we would look at staging where you were in terms of having kidney disease. And obviously, you can have a quite normal function but have a significant amount of protein, and that just puts you at a higher risk than having a low amount of protein. So it's more than one metric we look at. But based on where you are in that kind of cohort, it depends on which treatment we would go for to help stop your disease progressing. So you can't reverse majority of kidney failure or kidney disease. It's irreversible. So all we can do is stop the damage progressing.
So Nikki, what treatments can you give? Drugs?
So yes, I think what we would start with looking at lifestyle and nutrition and trying to reduce any further damage. So let's start with lifestyle. So obviously try and stop smoking. All those risk factors we talked about at the beginning, if your blood pressure is high, we need to get that blood pressure down. That's really, really important in patients with kidney disease. It's important in everyone, but particularly that, because if you leave your blood pressure high, it will continue to damage the kidney. And so your kidney disease will progress. Nutrition. Did you want to talk to us about nutrition? Because that's quite a complicated one, isn't it?
It is. So nutrition tends to be, in terms of kidney disease, if you're in the lower stages, so that 4 and 5, it's definitely led by a dietitian. So all of the kidney centres have a nutritionist who's specifically going to look at your levels, because depending on how well you're filtering, you just need to be careful of what you're having. As a rule, lots of sort of processed foods are quite bad for the kidney. So things that are high in phosphates, like cured meats or takeaways, all of those things can just put additional pressure on the kidney. So it gets quite complicated depending on your staging, but the best thing is to have a good balanced diet, not to overeat, not to have too much salt. That can change your fluid balance. If you're having too much salt, can actually make you hold more fluid.
And you remember we talked about potassium being high if the kidney is damaged. And another thing we look at is how much potassium is in the food you're eating. So for example, bananas have high potassium.
Yeah.
So not too many bananas.
Not too many bananas. It's not so vital in those stages, sort of.
This is
2 and 3. This is end stage. 4 and 5.
Yeah.
So you will find a whole host of bizarre things. So bananas have quite a bit, avocados, tomatoes have a lot, and mushrooms have some potassium.
Gosh, you've summed up my diet.
Yeah.
That's pretty miserable.
When it is, yeah.
So another thing we would do is make sure that you get your immunizations. So that's really important. And that's because, you know, the last thing you need is to get some overwhelming infection when your kidneys are already damaged. And then we look at managing the disease or the condition that's causing your kidney disease. So diabetes, for example, we would try and get that under control, and lowering any other risk factors for cardiovascular disease, because we know you've got a higher risk with kidney disease. So we also do use medication in kidney disease, but I'm going to pass over to Sarah for that, because she's also a pharmacist and knows a lot more about medications than I do.
Yes, so I am also, as well as having kidney disease, I'm also a pharmacist. So the mainstay of medication is, as Nikki said, your kidney shouldn't leak protein. I like to think of it as a sieve. So it's got quite tight holes. But then if you put your fish through a sieve, you're going to make those holes bigger. And that's how the protein falls out. So the first step of medication we use is a drug that tends to be used for having raised blood pressure. And the way what it does is it helps reduce that pressure. So it takes that fist off your kidney. So it helps those holes close back up and stops the protein coming out of it. So we tend to start that, and we increase that dose until you're as well tolerated as it can be. So if you start feeling dizzy or anything like that, we'd stop it. But we try and use that first. And then there is a new, quite exciting, for me anyway, quite exciting group of drugs come out. And now they're another mouthful. They are sodium glucose 2 transporter.
There's an L in there.
Yeah. So basically the way that they're called, an SGLT2, and some people might have known them as
inhibitor.
So an SGLT2 inhibitor, and some people might know them as Flozins, because they all end in flows in. They're all a bit of a mouthful, but the way they've now been some really good evidence that actually they slow the progression of kidney disease. And how they do that is that they change the pressure. So what we were talking about, these glomeruli, these little fingers that are the filters, they actually change the pressure inside those glomeruli. So it actually literally stops there being so much pressure through the filters as well. So they're really great drugs. And there's been some really good studies coming out. Guys who in my hospital, they've been involved in quite a lot of the studies of putting people on it and seeing how it reduces progression. But it also protects your heart from long-term complications. So yeah, it's a brilliant drug.
They're also used for diabetes.
They are.
So are they available in GPs throughout the country?
Yes.
And we then licensed by NICE. NICE are now saying that we should use these drugs in people with chronic kidney disease in a certain category. So, and the other thing is statins.
Yes.
So all people with kidney disease should be on a anti-cholesterol statin.
Right. I thought that was just for the heart, but obviously it's linked because of the pressure, yeah. Is it?
So someone with in their 20s with end-stage renal failure has the same cardiac outcomes as someone without it in their 80s. So by having kidney disease, you are deemed to be high risk of going on to have a heart attack or a stroke. In fact, it's one of the really early predictors of people that do go on. Most people who pass away from kidney disease or by having kidney disease actually tend to have a stroke or a heart attack before they get to the point of dialysis, because that increases such a huge increase in your cardiovascular system. The numbers of people on dialysis are not necessarily as high as you might expect, because people, compared to the number of people who have CKD, because people pass away before they get there.
Right. I think also there's some things to avoid, like you shouldn't be on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, another mouthful, but they are things like aspirin, ibuprofen, Nurofen, naproxen, Voltarol. There's like a little bit of a list of them, and people with kidney disease should be avoiding those because they can be harmful to the kidney. And there are, if you're in end-stage kidney failure, there are any other drugs really that are metabolized by the kidney. We have to adjust doses and things like that.
You mentioned dialysis. Could you tell me a bit more about that? It's something that I really know nothing about.
So dialysis is when you get to the point where your kidney function is so low that all of the toxins and all of the harmful bits start to build up, and you can become very, very unwell. There are three choices in terms of kidney disease of where you go. One of them is some people do choose, if they're much older, they choose to palliate. So they decide that actually they don't want to go on dialysis, they're not eligible for a transplant, and they would much rather just live with it. And they go into sort of palliative hospice care. That is one of the options that people do choose. The other options are dialysis. And so what dialysis does is obviously replace mainly the filter aspect of your kidneys. So it will only help with the water and the electrolytes. So it will only replace those. And there are two different types of dialysis. So there is, when you think of dialysis, there's the conventional one where you filter your blood. So that's something called hemodialysis. That's normally 4 hours a day, 4 hours, three times a week. So if you think that I said 180 litres a day, your kidneys filter 180 litres of blood a day, and they're working 24/7, you're only actually on dialysis for 12 hours.
With hemodialysis, what you would do is go into usually a centre for this, and you'd have a needle put in your arm. The blood would come out of your arm into a filtration system, an artificial kidney effectively, and then put back into your body. But as Sarah says, you can't instantly filter all the toxins out of your blood, and you do have to be connected to that machine for a long time in order for it to work.
So you're saying 4 hours, three times a week.
So it's like almost having another part-time job.
Yeah.
And you then need all sorts of drugs to help do everything else that we were saying. So you need to either have sort of calcium and phosphate tablets to help balance that. Some people might need, and you might have heard of these injections from certain cyclists. You can have injections that replace, it's called EPO, and it helps generate more red blood cells. You also need to take blood pressure tablets. There's lots of things that you have to take that will replace the natural function of your own kidney, vitamin D tablets. When people have been on dialysis for a long period, their kidneys eventually will stop producing urine. So then they end up being on, and this is when nutrition becomes really important. So patients come on a fluid restriction. So because they're only dialyzing three times a week, you can only limit the amount of fluid you can have. And also limiting sort of your food. So that's one option, which is the hemodialysis. So it's either through a line that gets put in your neck or in your arm. And that is the most common type of dialysis.
Does it hurt? I mean, aside from the needle being put in, does it feel strange having
it
that?
It feels a bit weird. You feel a little bit like you're on a washing machine. And some people can feel quite unwell on dialysis because your blood's being sucked out at a very high volume and then being put back in at a high volume. It's not painful. You just can feel quite dizzy and unwell when you're having it done because it just feels a little bit like you're being whizzed around a washing machine. So it's not the
best thing is because you're having to have a line put in three times a week, then you'll sometimes make something called a fistula, which is where you have a little bit of a surgical operation to make a site where they join
like a port to
put
in.
Exactly.
So it's like a super artery. So they gather loads of blood vessels and fuse them together.
Yes.
And you get a thrill on it. So if you put your fingers if you put your fingers on someone's fistula, you'll feel this thing that they call a thrill, which just feels
it's
a little bit
like a buzzy.
Like a buzzing.
Because it's connected to the artery.
So that's when you know that your fistula is ready to be used, is because you can start to feel this thrill on it. So it's quite fascinating that they can do it. People can do it either in centre or some people do it at home. So there are patients that do hemodialysis at home and people that do nocturnal hemodialysis. So it's much more gentle on your heart. So hemodialysis can be a bit rough on your heart because you're getting all that blood taken out and pumped back at quite high velocity. So some people choose to do home dialysis and there's lots of support in terms of getting that done, but it is a very long process to do. You need a lot of training because you have to needle yourself. You have to put them in yourself, set the machine up yourself. It takes up a lot of space in your house.
And did you do that?
No.
And you need more sessions a week, don't you?
Yeah. So you would do more sessions a week, but they would be longer and they would be slower. So people tend to find that okay. And the other option is peritoneal dialysis. So what happens in that is you get they insert, it looks a little bit like a coiled garden hose. So it's this with lots of holes in it, it's like a sprinkler. That gets inserted into your
peritoneal cavity.
So it gets put into your peritoneal cavity, which is basically the bit of your stomach that's between your stomach and the outside. And that works through diffusion. So you then have a port that comes out of your stomach. You attach yourself to, you either do manual exchanges where you fill your stomach with this glucose fluid that tracks all of the waste. You keep it in there for a dwell time of about 40 minutes normally, and then you drain it out. So some people do it manually, but more commonly you're on a cycler. So I did hemodialysis while I was in hospital, and then I was changed onto peritoneal dialysis. So I initially dialyzed overnight. So I dialyzed for about 8 hours, and then heading up towards my transplant, I was dialyzing 12 hours a night, every night. Peritoneal dialysis isn't for everyone, because if you've had any abdominal surgeries, it damages that pouch, so you can't actually fit it in. And over time, the glucose, it damages that mesh in there. So it's something that can tend to only be used short term. And eventually it stops working. You all need to
take it. Like your stomach expands, isn't it, with tears?
Yes. Yeah. And you slosh, which is a bit of a weird feeling.
So you mentioned a cycler. What's a cycler?
It's a machine that puts the fluid in for 40 minutes and then it takes it out. And then it does the same thing overnight. So you just put your fluid bags onto it. And then you set it up, push the button, and you can go to sleep.
So, Sarah, how long were you on dialysis for?
So I was really lucky. I don't want to use the word lucky in this context, but I was lucky that I was on dialysis just shy of a year. So I went on to dialysis the 24th of January 2019, and I had my transplant on the 3rd of January 2020. But I was really quite fortunate. The team I had at King's and Guy's, I was young, I was fit, I was well, and I was a pain in the behind. And so they just wanted me transplanted. And so they worked really hard to get my transplant done as quickly as possible. You had to be 6 months free. So I had the antibodies that were attacking my kidney. I needed to be negative of those for 6 months before they could officially start the transplant workup. The actual process of the transplant workup is quite involved. So you have to go through a whole series of testing yourself. You have to have a look at all your arteries, your heart, and just check that you're physically able to take the transplant. And also the same testing needs to be done on the person who's giving you the transplant. Now, I had a live donor, but you can get transplants from people who've passed away. So I had mine from a live donor. And so the donor had to go through an extensive testing process. They had to have a mental assessment to check that they were physically, mentally able to do it. And they had to have a whole series of blood tests, whole workup. And then you have to have a meeting with the independent tissue people to check that you're not buying or somehow brokering a kidney through them. So you have to make sure that you have a relationship with that person, and you have to show them evidence that you are not in any way either emotionally manipulating or financially gaining either way from receiving or donating the kidney. So it is quite a long procedure.
And who was your donor?
It was my mum.
Oh my goodness, that's so gorgeous.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
She was a match for you. And often does that happen? I mean, are relatives matches?
So there are. So there's the matching they do, it's across three different things. So you get three different numbers. So you would get between a 0 and 2. So my mum was a 1-1-1 match. Doesn't necessarily mean that she, which is a, you know, a good match.
Is 0 good and 2 bad, or other way around? 2 is good.
I don't know the answer.
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. They just said I could have it, and I said yes, please. So I was quite concerned because she was in her mid-60s when she gave me her kidney, and so I was obviously incredibly worried about my mum having surgery. But she kept telling me it won't look good in the press if I die giving you a kidney. So they're going to make sure that I'm fit and well, and they really did test her.
And so
thoroughly.
I mean, presumably people are okay to survive with one kidney.
The rate, actually, of kidney disease in people who donate a kidney is less than the normal population because they get such rigorous testing to go through it. They have actually radiation. So the way they do it is they give you a molecule that's radiated, and then they check the level of it. So they know exactly what your kidney function is. So they give you that, wait a few hours, and then take a blood sample, and they can check that marker of how well it's cleared out of your body. So they know to the T exactly what their function is. Her function hasn't changed. So between giving my kidney, her function hasn't changed. And actually, my kidney function is now better than hers.
It's extraordinary. So her kidney is functioning better in your body than it was in her body.
And her singular kidney has picked that slack up of the other kidney.
It's extraordinary.
And where in your body did they put the kidney?
Yes. My mum went down first thing. So she went round down at about 9 a.m. to theatre, and they took out her kidney. Now, to get a kidney out, it's quite difficult because it's right at your back. So it's just under your rib cage at the back of you. And so the way you get it out is you do almost a C-section incision. So you slice open just under your belly button. The surgeon, or now the robot, but somebody has to put their hand inside and hold your kidney while the other surgeons keyhole and cut it out. And then the kidney gets...
From your back?
Yeah. So you're lying down. They put your hand in...
At the front?
At the front. Someone puts their hand up inside you.
Goodness me.
So that put you very much like a puppet. And then they cut out that, they grab the kidney and then they pull it out. And in fact, my mum's first thing when she saw the surgeon was to say, how big are your hands? Because she's about 5 foot nothing. And she was wondering. So they had a surgeon with very tiny hands go and collect the kidney from her. I went down probably about an hour later. We had the same anaesthetist. And then they took her kidney out, checked it was fine. As soon as they knew it was fine, they took me through and anaesthetized me. Now, it's quite difficult. Like, her operation was significantly worse than mine because she had to, obviously, it's a real big deal to get that taken out. So they don't take out your kidney. So I still have my two original kidneys. They just don't work. And so what they do is they put it in at the front. So they connect it. Your blood supply is your femoral artery. So I have, and then it directly links to your bladder in the front. And so I have it in my bottom right of my abdomen. So I have a sliced scar across there. There's a bit like a hockey stick scar that kind of goes from my pubic bone up to the side of my hip. And they just pop the kidney in there.
And is there any disadvantage in having your kidney on the front of your body rather than the back of your body?
I shouldn't play high contact sports because I'm more likely to, it's got less protection around it. I still ski, I still snowboard, still horse ride. Like, it doesn't prevent me. But when I am skiing, I'm really conscious that I don't, you know,
so that's
on it.
That's why the body was designed with it in the back.
Yes.
So that it was
protected.
Ah, brilliant.
But it would be a huge operation to have my original ones removed. But also sometimes your plumbing's gone a bit wrong anyway. So when you're having your kidneys, your transplant put in,
you don't want to connect it to dodgy plumbing that's going to fail.
Some people's plumbing's already dodgy. And actually, when they scan me now, if I have a scan, they can see that my kidneys, my original kidneys have kind of shriveled themselves up and they are just normal functioning. So actually having it in my front is much better.
And how long will this kidney last?
It's hard to say. So because medicine's evolving so quickly, we're kind of working on old data all the time. So they normally say 10 to 15 years is the length of an average kidney. But there are some people that have their kidney and they unfortunately fail very quickly. So what they look for when they have the transplant is you urinating on the table, is what they say. And so they catheterize you. And a good kidney, a great kidney, they plug it in and straight away it makes urine. And so mine did. I actually beat the ward record of the amount of urine produced in 24 hours. Post-transplant, 11 litres.
Wow.
Wow, that's gracious.
That's about...
I lost about 10 kilos in after surgery in the 3 days because I had so much fluid overload that my kidneys weren't filtering.
Yes.
And it was hidden in between all of my tiny bone, like the tiny parts of my ribs and everything like that. It was all very secreted around. And so when they plumbed my kidney in, it just went into overdrive and filtered all of that fluid out.
That's fantastic.
Extraordinary.
Some people aren't quite so lucky. So some people's kidneys don't take, and it takes a while for them. They have to stay on dialysis for a bit for the kidney. You can get a sleepy kidney is what they call it. Takes a while to wake up. Other people's will fail very quickly. Some people don't have had their kidneys that have lasted to sort of 40, 50 years. So it's really a movable feast. And so no one really knows how long their transplant will last.
And what sort of medication do you have to have?
So you have to be on immunosuppression. So because my kidney is foreign from my mum, so it's not part of my natural body, my immune system, for they just plumbed it in and let me go, my immune system would actually start to attack the kidney because it would see it as foreign.
Reject it.
Mm. Exactly. So they have to give you a medication that suppresses your immune system. So I'm on three different drugs to suppress my immune system. Different people have different protocols. So the number changes, but you are on a significant dose of immunosuppression to make sure that your immune system does not recognize your kidney. Now, that's constantly a balance because that medication also is toxic to your kidney. So you're in this constant level of flux of not wanting to give too much of the drug because you can cause damage and horrible side effects as well, but giving enough that you keep that immunosuppression, keep that kidney hidden from your immune system, if you like. But it does mean that if you are more likely to get colds, you're more likely to pick up viruses and infections. And any time you pick up a virus or an infection, you stimulate your immune system. So it's always a risk when you catch something. So you're more likely to catch things. And when you do catch them, they stick around for a bit longer. And you're more likely when you catch those to go into rejection because your immune system then starts to have a bit of a flourish. Yeah.
And so vaccination is very important.
Vaccination is very important. So before I had my transplant, because mine was very much planned, I had to ensure that I had all vaccinations up to date.
Are you involved with any charities or have you been helped by any charities?
So there's two main kidney charities. One of them is Kidney Research UK, and they do amazing work in terms of researching kidneys, surprisingly. But they research what causes kidney disease, lots of research into that. But they're also looking more now at how to prevent rejection, ways in which they can continue kidneys lasting. And they are doing some more research. So Andy Cole, the footballer, he has a transplant and he realised that while you're dialysing and on the workup, you have this huge series of appointments. You have your transplant and then you have about 3 months where they see you all the time. And then you drop down to 3 monthly and you're very much kind of thrown off a bit of a cliff. So he's working with kidney research to look into improving the psychological support across nationwide to make sure that people are primed for kind of being just sent out into the world to function and not be tied to a dialysis machine. It's a very weird psychological thing to get your head around that you're not cured, you're still having to take all these medication, but you're also not tethered to a machine for a lot of hours of the day. So it's quite difficult. The other charity that's an amazing charity is Kidney Care UK. They are a patient charity, so they are there solely to support patients. They provide counselling completely free at point of access. I've had counselling from them and they've been phenomenal.
How common is it that you find a transplant match? I mean, it seems to me that your mum was an absolutely amazing lady to do this for you. You know, can you talk about that a bit?
I mean, you could not have stopped my mum giving me this kidney. So she was giving me that kidney regardless. She was going to keep going until they told her she couldn't go any further.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but so you can have... So people can donate kidneys completely anonymously. So there are some people who just decide one day that they're going to donate a kidney. That's one option. You can have a selected live donor where you know you get your friends and family tested and they proceed down that route. with friends and family, they never tell you. So I found this difficult because I was itching to know every piece of information about the pathway the whole way. But they never told me any of my mum's results until the day that we were doing the transplant, because at any point she could back out and they wouldn't tell me why. So you're completely free to change your mind at any point and they won't break that confidentiality. So you can just go and get tested and see. Then the other way of doing it is matches. So say Nikki wanted to just give me a kidney, but we weren't a match. We could go into a pool donation where Nikki will be matched with somebody else who she was a match for. They would have a donor that would match for me. And you can get those, that can be up to 12, a chain of about 12 different transplants going on.
Coordination, and that must be...
Yeah, all across the country. And then the final one is a cadaver donor, so someone who's passed away in hospital, and they all harvest. Sounds awful when they say they'll harvest their organs. They will take their organs, and a person who donates their organs can save up to 9 lives. And I think it's a really beautiful thing to be able to know that you can't take them with you, but to be able to know that that person passed away and that they then helped give the gift of life again to another 9 people, and know that they live on in that legacy, because people who have kidneys are, or any organ transplant, are so incredibly grateful for that.
I wondered 2 things. It's something that we ask everybody on our podcasts. One of the things was, what would you say to someone starting out on this journey? And what have you learned that you could pass on? Mm-hmm. And the second thing I wanted is what you would say to your mum.
I'll come to that one because that made me cry. For someone that's starting on the journey, I would say, if you're in that fortunate position where you have a small decline in your kidney function, preserve it. You are in a fortunate position where you are able to preserve it. So making sure you're eating well, your blood pressure's well controlled, you know, you're keeping an eye on your weight, you're exercising, you're not smoking, your blood sugars are controlled. Yeah, but just making sure that you are living the healthiest life that you can.
And would you say to people also that it's worth considering signing up to transplant your organs?
Yeah.
I think now it's assumed that you will unless you...
Yeah, so it's difficult because your family actually have final say. So you may sign up to the... It's assumed, it's an opt-in, opt-out method now. So it's assumed, unless you have opted out, that you did want to give them. But they will always ask your next of kin, your family, what they want to do. So it's not good enough just not saying anything. You need to have those
conversations to your next of kin.
You need to have those conversations with your family and make it very, very clear that that's what you want, that you want your organs to be donated if you were in any way in that case. And for anyone that's struggling with, you know, for anyone, for God forbid, in that situation where they're having to think about what they do with a relative or family member's organs, they can't take them with them, but you can save 9 people's lives, completely change their lives by donating them.
Mm. Well, what would you say to your mum?
She birthed me, but she's given me the complete gift of life again. Like, it's, I will always well up when I talk about this because there are not enough words to say how grateful I am for her. Yeah, it's just amazing, really. And thank you is all I can say. Like, there isn't enough words to say anything apart from she's the most amazing woman I've ever met.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was absolutely, you know, brilliant and absolutely fascinating.
I mean, that we both learnt. I mean, I've learnt so much talking to you, and you're an inspiration, I think, to our listeners.
We hope you've enjoyed this month's podcast. Don't forget that if this has made you aware of troubling medical symptoms, you may need to see your GP.
This has been an I Am Listening exclusive podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.